We're going to be talking about establishing authority. Remember that we talked about the fact that authority was a key factor in the personality makeup of each individual, that authority, affection and ambition are the three main drives of the human individual, and authority is the primary factor. If authority is a settled matter, there can be an integration of those propensities or drives so that you become increasingly a mature person for whom those three things are not taking you off in other directions, but the three of them are integrated to give you a purpose in life and a meaning in life and the full resolution of all the forces and the talents and abilities that have been built into you. And so we're going to be talking in this first study, which is the second study, who shines? And we're thinking about establishing authority. Before we start to establish authority in the way that may be appropriate to you, let me take you back to your church, because you may be looking for a new pastor. And I years ago saw in the granny column, column 8 of the Sydney Morning Herald, this wonderful thought: and now for something completely different in chain letters, as received by Graham Begbie, the astonished rector of St Matthew's Church of England, Ashbury. This is the chain letter. Dear friend, please send a copy of this letter to six other churches which are tired of their ministers. Then bundle up your pastor and send him to the church at the top of the list. Add your name to the bottom of the list. In 1 week, you will receive 16,436 ministers. One of them should be a dandy. Have faith in this letter. One church broke the chain and got its old minister back. The establishing of authority is a very important factor. And I want you to see several things, but first of all I'm going to ask you to open out the two pages, study 1 and 2, because I'm going to transpose the bit in under study 2, Exodus 3. I'm going to take that over into the first part of our thinking together, because it comes in this respect, that there is a natural resistance to authority. You are a rebel. Oh no, you say. I was whipped into shape as a kid. You got so much instruction at the seat of wisdom that you have been a good little fellow or good little girl ever since. You are a rebel. You will always be a rebel until there comes that wonderful moment when we see him as he is and we're changed into his likeness, and we'll be thinking about that a little more later on. But as a rebel, you have a natural reaction to authority. Who says? And we immediately bristle. Of course, it's lovely to have the hair of you at the back of your, and that sort of thing, when there's something wonderfully emotionally moving. But there are few things that move you emotionally more than someone wanting to lord it over you. And there's a natural resistance to authority, and we see it in Exodus chapter 3 when Moses is called by God into a wonderful opportunity, into a ministry for which he was specially prepared. And Moses didn't want to come to the party very readily. In verse 11 of chapter 3, Moses brings out the first of his questions as to why he shouldn't do what God called him to do. And he says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Who am I? And that's a good question for any of us. Who am I? You can get the wrong answer to it, and kid yourself a bit, but at the same time, you are called of God, and God does not say that you need to be anybody in particular. He doesn't answer that you are a wonderful person. He says, I will be with you. And that's the whole point of it. It's not a matter of who you are. Don't get an inferiority complex. You are inferior. The Bible describes how you were chosen. Not many mighty, not many rich, not many great. The foolish things of the world God has chosen, and you made it. You were qualified. So you are inferior. So don't have a complex about it. Just accept the fact. That's not where your greatness is to be found. Who am I? And you can resist authority on the basis of, not for me, who am I? It's not a matter of who you are. It's a matter of who sent you. I was talking to someone this morning who reminded me of an old mate of mine, and the first time I was in business as a delivery boy in Winchcombe Carson in Sydney, I was two burps on a buzzer to the boss. Very important, I tell you. I was the junior, just arrived out of school, wet behind the ears, didn't know what it was all about, made very many foolish blunders. I remember when one time the boss called me in and he said, Fletcher, I want you to go down to get me some sauterne. Well, I'd never heard of sauterne. And he said, you know where I get it? I said, on Macready's. He said, where's Macready's? I said, that's the chemist in Macquarie Place. He said, sauterne, boy, you don't get sauterne at a chemist? Well, I thought sauterne, sauteau, saw anything, you know, kind of, that's where you'd get it. He said, go to the Plateau Ship Hotel. And I had a moment, and I said, I'm sorry, sir, I've never been in a hotel. Do you mind if I don't go? Oh, boy, that was a moment, wasn't it? And he said, no, send the other boy in. And the other boy came in. He was older than me. He not only knew about the hotel, he went there regularly. And but the interesting thing was I got the next rise in position. God honours you for the things that you're willing to do if they're in line with his will and purpose, and you do them for that reason. It's not a matter of who you are, but I was just two burps on a buzzer. One day the buzzer burped and I raced in, and the boss said, get me so-and-so. Now this mister was a so-and-so. He was a real nasty bit of goods. And I went out and I stood alongside him, poor little kid, you know. There I was, can you imagine it? There I was, poor little kid, standing alongside this great blustering boss of my department. And I said, excuse me, sir. He said, stand up. So I stood there. I said, excuse me, sir. Look, you can see I'm busy now. I'll be present with you in a minute. So I waited. And eventually, he said, now, what do you want? I said, HB wants you. That was the boss. He said, well, why didn't you say so? Well, I tried to. And do you know what happened? I had him running at my word. It wasn't a matter of who I was, it was who sent me. And you are not important. Don't pull that up as a kind of reason why you needn't accept the authority of God in being commissioned to shine. It's not a matter of who you are, it's a matter of who sent you. So Moses brings up his next one. He says, what'll I tell them? And God shares with him his secret name. I am that I am. The name that was never to be allowed to come to the lips of a Jew, but came to the lips of Jesus so often that they were scared of him. I am the bread of life. Before Abraham was, I am Yah. But here Moses was given that secret name of God, and if you're going to people, if you're going to be a shining light, it will come only as you come from the presence of God with the glory of the Lord upon you. So you don't need to be concerned about what you'll tell them. This is what you are to say to the Israelites: I am hath sent me to you. And Moses comes again in chapter 4. What if they don't believe or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? And then the Lord gives him two signs. And we haven't time to go into all the detail of these things, but one of them was the sign of a changed life. He throws his rod on the ground and it becomes a snake, and a real one. And God said, now take it by the tail. He took it by the tail gingerly and it became a rod again in his hand. He said, this is the sign. And that's the sign of a changed life. You are a person that would naturally get it over somebody else. You know the golden rule. You live by the golden rule. Do others before they do you. And there you've got the whole idea, or the one who's got the gold rules. These are the things that we've had worked into us by the society in which we live. And you will benefit yourself at the expense of others if you possibly can. You're a rebel at heart. But God says, I can change you, and when you are a changed person, that will convince them. And the other one was, he puts his hand into his cloak and it comes out leprous, and then he puts it back and it comes out clean. And it'll be that changed life that people see. What is the sign of the Christian church? Many people think it's a cross. But Jesus said, you destroy this body. That's the mark of man's work, the cross. I will raise it again. And it is the resurrection life that is the sign of the Christian church. When you're full of love and joy and peace and patience and meekness and faith and self-control, that's a sign to the world that something's happened to change you. And that becomes a sign. And then Moses comes back and says, I'm slow of speech. I'm not equipped. I haven't got the gifts. Well, that would have finished it, wouldn't it? But God says to him, who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or dumb? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I the... Hey, if you were the Lord, wouldn't you shut up about some of the mistakes you made? I mean, you know, God has been inefficient that he's put some people together and they've turned out dumb, and others have turned out blind, and some are deaf. Wouldn't you have shut up about your mistakes? Hey, who said they were mistakes? God doesn't admit them as mistakes. He says, who made the deaf, the dumb, and the blind? Have not I the Lord? If you, Moses, think you're slow of speech and I'm calling you, don't you think I've equipped you in the way that I want you equipped for the work? And you mustn't tell God when he calls you to something, you know, I haven't got the gifts. You've got the gifts, all right, or God wouldn't have called you. And then Moses comes the last final plea. And he says, oh my Lord, it's beautiful in the Authorized Version, if you don't mind me quoting the old King James Version, it says, oh my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. What the heck does that mean? In plain English it says, send somebody else. But oh, doesn't it sound spiritual? Oh my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. And the Lord lost his block with him. The anger of the Lord was burned against Moses, and he said, what about your brother? Don't think that you can retreat into some very spiritual, prayerful state that's going to absolve you from being obedient. Oh yes, you'll have this natural resistance to the authority of God, but I want you to look at these four examples of where God causes someone to come into the acceptance of his authority. The first one is Moses in the beginning of that chapter 3, where Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And in the 6th verse, the Lord said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. The first thing that Moses had to recognize was the person that was calling him, the authority that was being exercised in the vocation that was extended to him. I am God. And then in verse 10, he says, I am sending you. Go now, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And the third thing that happened in chapter 5 and verse 1, after all the other things we've been talking about, the resistance that Moses tried to raise up, in chapter 5 verse 1, it says, Moses and Aaron went. And so you've got these three stages of development: the recognition of authority, the delegation of authority, and the assumption of authority. Moses went. Now that little bit after their metamorphosis and transfigured, that actually goes a bit down. Don't blame the people who put this together. If you saw the scribbled notes that I sent them and see the amazing job they've done with the rubbish I sent, it's just something else. Would you send the notes of your talk? I didn't have them, but I had to get them, and I got them in a hurry, and I posted. Actually, I gave them to Garth and asked him to post them. I didn't want them to be delayed by me being tardy with my stamps or something. And off they went, and this is how they came back. What a wonderful job they've done. Metamorphosis and transfigured goes down to the next three, and can be a heading kind of thing of the next three, because here we find the introduction in the New Testament of this word metamorphosis. It's a Greek word and couldn't have got into the Old Testament except in the ancient Septuagint, but here we are. Metamorphosis, the word that means transfigured, or is translated transfigured, and appears only three times in the New Testament. And the first one is the instance that we well know of in Matthew 17 and the first five verses of that chapter. Matthew 17, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And while he was still speaking, a bright cloud enveloped them, and a voice from the cloud said, This is my son whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. And when the disciples heard this, they fell down on the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. Get up, he said. Don't be afraid. When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. And as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. And so we've got in this passage those three developments. First of all, the recognition of authority. And there was no way in which they could gainsay the authority in whose presence they were. Here they were on the top of the mountain, and suddenly Jesus assumes this form that terrified them. And it's a sad day for us when we can recognize God without a sense of awe. When we can get to the point of familiarity, when we can call our Heavenly Father Daddy in a kind of flippant and irreverent way. I'm not saying that people who use that form of speech are being flippant, but I'm saying it's easy to slip into a flippancy. And there is no place for flippancy in the presence of God. God is a fearful God. God is an awesome God. We need to be filled with the fear of the Lord. And you say, fear of the Lord? You mean the God that I love, I'm to be frightened of him? That's not what that word means. How do you express fear in the sense of the fear of the Lord? The only illustration that I can think of, have thought of over the years, is the illustration of a mother who has just given birth to her firstborn. And she's still in the hospital, and they're looking after the little one, and she just has to cuddle and feed that little one at a time. But now she's come home, and she's all on her own at home, and she has to bath this little one. And there's a certain sense of fear. She takes this trembling little body and she does what's necessary for this little life with a sense of fear. Is she frightened of that child? Of course not. The kid wasn't going to get up and smack her with anything. There's a fear, there's a beautiful fear. She fears lest with her own clumsiness or folly she could damage this precious little life. And so with a fear bred of her own insufficiency and her own weakness and her deep abiding love, she fears. And as we look into the face of the Father, and we remember that time when his face was turned from his beloved son as he hung on the cross, he who knew no sin made sin for us, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. As you look into the face of the Father and you see in him the pain of having to turn his face from his son in that awful moment, and you hear the shrieking cry of a wounded soul as he who knew no sin, had never had a wrong thought, had poured upon him all the filth and sewage of man's sin from eternity past to the time that man ceases to be on this planet. All that was rotten and filthy of man was poured upon him, and the Father's face was turned away as the Son shrieked in agony, not for the nails, not for the crown of thorns, but for the awfulness of being made sin. And he cries out in agony, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" If you can go through that and lose an awesomeness, a fearfulness. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, because you'll fear lest you should grieve one that you love so much. It's a fear that's born of a love. It's a fear that's born of a recognition of your own folly and your own rebelliousness, your own filthiness. And you fear lest you should grieve him, lest you should hurt him. That's the fear of the Lord that is the beginning of wisdom. And Jesus is recognized as the authority, and the authority is delegated by the Father as he says, "This is my Son, listen to him." And the Son says, "Don't tell anybody about this until after I'm risen from the dead." Transfigured before them. And that word transfigured is the word metamorphosis in the Greek. It comes again in chapter 3 of the second epistle to the Corinthians, where we find that there's a transfiguration that is not the transfiguration of Jesus, or it's not seen to be immediately the transfiguration of Jesus. It's the transfiguration of those that are his. It's the glory of the New Testament. As we look at the 18th verse of the third chapter of 2 Corinthians, "And we who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory are being transformed." We are being transfigured. That's the same word, metamorphosis. And you are meant to, upon the mountaintop, be transfigured in the presence of the world. You are meant to be transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. Are you being transformed, transfigured? The glory of the Lord needs to be recognized. And then as you feed upon him in your heart by faith, as you walk with the Lord in the light of his word, as you meditate upon these things, you become transformed into his likeness, increasingly into his likeness. One day, I'm going to be just like the Lord Jesus. Yes, I'll listen, fella. Don't build your hopes up too much. You're so far off, it could never happen. Well, I've got the promise of the book. And you might think it's an awful leap because you haven't seen enough progress toward it to give you the hope that it might happen. But the Bible says it will happen. And for some of us, it has been happening over the years, and we're being transformed into the likeness of Christ. For some of us, it's going to be a terrific transformation at the last minute. But it wasn't meant to be that way. It was meant to be a daily being conformed to his image, daily being transformed into his likeness as we reflect the Lord's glory. That glory which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. How does this happen? Well, we go to Romans 12. And those two first verses that you know so well, have quoted so often. "I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed," that's the word, transfigured, "by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and to prove what God's will is, his good, pleasing and perfect will." All of us are interested, as the Spirit of God has opportunity to minister to us, we're increasingly interested in God's will for our lives. We are probably where we are in the place of appointment, in the ministry that we have, because we believe that's where God wants us to be. We believe it's the will of God for us. And the will of God is the most important thing that can happen to you. Some people get the idea that the will of God is the last straw. Do you know what God wants of you? He wants to make you a hat missionary in a malarial swamp among pygmy lepers, and you know it. Who is this God that has that kind of a program for people? I mean, if my little kid had come to me years ago and said, "Daddy, I love you and I'll do anything you want me to do," would that have brought the worst out in me? And I'd look at this little kid and said, "Right, son, I've been waiting for this moment. I'm going to lock all your toys in the cupboard and you're going to eat nothing but spinach three times a day. I know you hate it, but it's good missionary training." Do you reckon? Hey, tell me if I'm as bad as that and I'll just perish. No, if your kid had come to you and expressed his love to you, you'd melt, wouldn't you? You old rascal. You'd just melt and say, "Son, this is a lovely day. What can we do together?" And you'd think up some wonderful program you could be involved with together as a fellowship together of a son and a father and a mother who love one another. Wouldn't you? And God has a wonderful plan, not just for now. God has a plan for every day of the whole of your life. I remember we had some terrific meetings in Sydney Town Hall, and we had a week, and the town hall packed, and we had two wonderful speakers. One was a doctor from the United States, a doctor of divinity, and another was a bishop of the Anglican Church, and they each had 45 minutes to speak, and I can't remember a thing they said. But we had a woman, girls, don't you get the wrong idea on this, we had a woman who had 5 minutes in the program. And I'll never, as long as I live, forget what she said. Now, it was because she was a woman, and it wasn't because she was a woman she only had 5 minutes. We had grabbed her from another program, and that was all she could make available, and we put her into the midst of the program, but I'll never forget what she said. I'd done a very foolish thing, as I look back on it. It was Marge Saint. And it was soon after the epic episode where those five missionaries had landed on that beach in Ecuador among the Arca Indians and been martyred. And Marge Saint was the wife of the pilot, Nate Saint. And she'd come to Sydney, and we'd got her for this 5 minutes to share with us. And I'd got the choir that was right up behind her to sing, "We Rest on Thee." And you remember in the closing verse of that hymn, it says, "When passing through the gates of pearly splendour, we rest on thee." And that was the name of the book they wrote about that episode. And that was the hymn that this little company, five families, had sung together as those missionaries had gone out on that fateful journey. And when they came to that final line, "When passing through the gates of pearly splendour," poor Marge Saint just contracted into herself in one tremendous sigh. And I said, "You idiot, to have put her through that torture just before she had to speak. That was idiocy." But she got up, choked, and started. And she said, "Nate and I wanted only two things in life." If I could say to you with authority, "I can give you any two things you want," what would you be asking for? My little four-cylinder job, it's in need of a bit of repair. We could do with a new set of tyres. And actually, we've got one of those washing machines that doesn't wash and breaks down, and we'd like a new one of those. Or perhaps you'd like a stereo set or something, and we could organise that for you, because I'd have all the authority and the resources. We'd be able to fix it up for you. What would you be asking for? Well, you know better than to ask for that sort of thing. And so did Marge and Nate Saint. Nate and I wanted only two things in life: to know the will of God and to do it. To know it and to do it. And to know the will of God, to know what authority wants in your life, so that you can shine with all the authority of God, so that you're being transformed into the image and likeness of His Son, so that our generation has Jesus walking the streets of the cities and bypaths that we traverse in time. Wouldn't that be the greatest thing that could happen for you? Well, here we're told how it happens, and there are three steps to knowing the will of God. The first is, you must be teachable. By nature, none of us are teachable. We're rebels. I remember I had the occasion in Air Force days as a flying instructor, we had the air training cadets, and they used to march around in Air Force uniforms on parade grounds in Air Force stations, and they studied aeroplanes in models, and they looked at pictures, and they read the manuals and got all the theory. But once or twice a year we used to take them up in an aeroplane above the clouds, and there they could see what it was to be an airman. And I had one of these kids in the front seat of a tiny Tiger Moth, and we were just taking off, and I'd got the tail up and we were getting across the field about to get off the ground, and a voice came through and said, "Righto, sir, taking over, what do you want me to do?" Well, I don't care who you are, you don't take over during a takeoff or a landing. One person does that, unless there's an emergency and he collapses and dies or something. It's a good idea then to have the other person do something. But normally, one person does the job for taking off and landing. So I had to summon all my instructor skill in that moment and deal with him as I knew well how to deal with a pupil. And I said, "Sit still and shut up!" And he did. And when we got to about 8,000 feet, which in a Tiger Moth takes nearly all day, I said to him, "Righto, son, let's see what you can do." Well, we went all over the sky. We were this way and that way, and we were every way. And eventually a terrified voice said, "I think you better take it, sir." Well, I'd been thinking that for about 2 or 3 minutes. But I didn't want to balk him. I wanted him to have his go. And he had his go, and he was terrified. You see, he'd read the book, but he hadn't really got the message. He hadn't got the picture plain. And he thought he knew. And that's the trouble with most of us. We think we know. Do you know, one time I was talking to 600 people all over the age of 60. Some of them were over 70. There were some over 90. And I had to speak something relevant to them. What could I say that would get their attention? But I had their measure. I said, "You know the trouble with young people today?" And every old grey head nodded. "Kids today know everything, little blighters." 2 weeks later, I was speaking to the youth happening at Belgrave Heights, and there were over 2,000 young people and boxes of noise behind me. And there I was in this atmosphere. What was an old bloke like me going to say to 2,000 youngsters? But I had their measure. I said, "You know the trouble with old people today? They know everything. They knew it when it was just green fields. They knew his grandmother. They knew he married and they had..." And oh, these old people that go into their dotage and forget that it's an anecdotage they get into. It's a terrible thing. And all these kids agreed. Then we come to a nice mature group like this. Do you know the trouble with a group like this? You know everything. You've read the story of the feeding of the 5,000, of raising of Lazarus, you've read Romans, and you've read Hezekiah, and you've read the lot. And you know it all. Right through Sunday school you went. And you know, if you think you know everything, you're not going to learn anything. You've got to be teachable, or you're not going to learn. Now, how do you become teachable? Well, that's what we're talking about. You need to be transformed, transfigured, bright and shining, as Jesus was, as he was transfigured. You need to be transfigured. That's the same word. Transformed by the renewing of your mind. A metamorphosis has to take place. That word metamorphosis is a Greek word, but we've taken it over into the English. You often use it, don't you? You probably metamorphosis this morning, did you? You didn't. Well, you didn't go for your early morning walk, or you might have metamorphosis. You see, a metamorphosis is the name we give to a change that takes place. When a grub, in a slimy grub in a cocoon, is transformed into a free-flying butterfly, a metamorphosis has taken place. And you need to be changed from grub thinking to the freedom of the sons of God. A metamorphosis must take place. You must be transfigured by the renewing of your mind. How does that mind become renewed? Change your library. No, that's not what it's all about. It's not a matter of knowledge. It's a matter of mindset. It's a matter of what you have a mind to do. It's what you change when you change your mind. It's the purpose of your thinking. You need to be transformed by the renewing of your mind, and that is the work of the Spirit of God. He will change you as the Spirit of God, who has His presence within you, is able to take of the things of Christ and make them real and relevant to you. You'll be transformed. You won't be thinking about the self-focused thought, the thing that you want to do. You'll have the mind of Christ. You'll want to do what God wants of you. Authority will be established within you. How does that happen? There's a third thought. Oh, you could think, Paul is on very spiritual ground here, being transfigured as Jesus was on the mountain, face shining, raiment pure, as full as earth. What wonderful spiritual ritual would bring you into this situation? We need to hush as we think of this very spiritual ritual. Paul says a very earthy, physical thing. Present your bodies. Oh, really, Paul? Couldn't you be more spiritual than that? Present your body. You know, that's the only way you can express yourself. If I came to your place and had left my body at home, don't know how I'd do it, but say I did, and you became conscious of the fact that I was at the door, the dog smelt me or something, and you went to the door because somebody was at the door, and you looked there, and because I hadn't brought my body, you couldn't see me, you'd be inclined to say, oh, there's no body here. And you'd be quite correct. I was there, but no body. And you cannot be somebody without a body. And if you are going to be used of God, if your mind is going to be transformed, if you are going to be teachable, you present your body. It's as plain as that. If you want your body to be doing your things, if you want to be on your little excursion, if you want to be on your little adventure, off you go, your mind set on the things of this world, and you'll never know the will of God for your life. You'll wander around looking for something to excite you. But when you put your body on the line, He will transform you by transfiguration. A metamorphosis will take place. You'll be renewed in your mind. You'll have the mind of Christ, and you'll prove what is that good, acceptable, and perfect will of God for your life. or it may not be exactly what you hoped for. But it will work together to achieve what God had in mind for you when He put you together. Remember the story of the little nurse who was triple certificated, and she wanted to be in charge of her hospital, and she went out with a missionary society knowing that with three certificates she'd be sure someday to be in charge of her own hospital. And she got out there and she found herself moved from one place to another. Somebody was going on furlough and they put her over there to fill the gap. Somebody else had fallen sick and so they put her in to fill the gap. And something else happened over here. They were short-staffed for one reason or other. They put her in to fill the gap. And she thought, oh, here I am. I do nothing but plug gaps. And then she discovered a verse that became very meaningful to her. That you may prove what is that good, G, acceptable, A, and perfect, P, will of God, G-A-P. She was filling gaps because that's what God wanted of her. And when there came a time when they needed a person who knew all of the different situations, who'd been this here and that there and had been over at this place, she was the perfect person for that position because she'd filled the gaps in those places. And God was working out His perfect will for her. And as you establish the authority in your life, you recognize the authority. You have all that is required by that authority delegated to you, and then you assume the role that God has prepared for you, as He did in those instances. You'll know what is that good, acceptable, and perfect will of God.